Welcome to Behind the Curtain, LA Opera's podcast series in which we look deeply at the creative process and explore opera's enduring themes and power to move us. Written in 1942 under the title A Southern Interlude, William Grant Still's Highway 1 USA was not performed by a professional opera company until 2021. In this podcast, Dr. Tiffany Kuo explores the work's production history and reception. Tickets to Highway 1 USA are available now at laopera.org.
William Grant Still, the prolific Black composer of the 20th century, completed Highway 1 USA in 1942. But its premiere was 21 years later, in 1963, and its first and only recording of the full opera not until 2005. And only in the last 4 years has the opera entered professional opera companies' repertory. In this episode, we will dive into the work's performance history from its completion in 1942 till today. The work's reception is one that mirrors contemporaneous American race politics, from Jim Crow disenfranchisement of Black Americans to post-civil rights Black Power movement to post-George Floyd call for reparations. I delineate this history into three periods. The first, from 1942 to 1962, which I call the silent period, when the work remained dormant, that is, unstaged. The second period begins in 1963, its premiere in Miami. This period lasts about a decade and a half to the late 1970s. During the second period, several HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, and Black opera companies produced Highway 1. Then, in the third period, from the 1980s and onward, the work slowly enters the repertory of professional opera companies across the nation. I divide the performance history into these three periods to offer two stories. The first is a story of Still's struggle as a Black composer in the predominantly white genre of opera. And the second is the unintended consequence of how Highway 1 became a Black opera. So let's begin with the first period, from 1942 to 1962. I start with a particular intention specified by composer William Grant Still and librettist Verna Arve, and that is Highway 1 USA, or at the time known as A Southern Interlude, was to be racially ambiguous. We know this because in a letter written by Still to an opera impresario dated 1946, Still described the plot and subject matter of the opera as such. Quote, "The story is American, but original with us. And although it is set in the South, there is nothing racial about it." Still then reiterates the racial ambiguity of the opera by providing remarks of an Alabama white man who had heard excerpts. Still writes, quote, "After hearing the music and the story, he remarked to my wife that he felt that this particular opera would be a powerful force for goodwill in the South simply because of the absence of propaganda and the fact that the story is about the drama in the life of one particular family." End quote. By specifying that there is nothing racial about the opera because of the absence of propaganda, Still was implying that he and Arve intended the opera to be performed by any race. Unfortunately, the opera impresario Charles Wagner did not accept the work. His rejection was one of five in the two decades following the work's completion. The lack of success in the 1940s and 50s reflect systemic racial discrimination in the predominantly white and male Western classical music sphere, both in the US and in Europe. Three rejections were contests: the Alice Ditson Fund, the Metropolitan Opera, and La Scala. During the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, only one Black musician was a recipient, conductor Dean Dixon in 1948 for the Ditson Prize. The fifth rejection was from the manager of Punch Opera based in New York City. I highlight the racial ambiguity of Highway 1 and the five rejections because I want to differentiate Highway 1 from Still's three previous operatic works, Blue Steel, Troubled Island, and The Bayou Legend. The plots of these three works centered on Black people and Black history. And in this period, from the 40s to the early 60s, only one of these three works had witnessed a full performance, which was Troubled Island. In other words, Highway 1 USA was the first opera that was not race or ethnic specific, and it was deliberately so to solicit a broader reception and acceptance in the white operatic world. As musicologist Gail Murchison noted, quote, "In the 1930s, Still had moved beyond the racial style to compose in what he considered his universal style," end quote. And yet, despite its racial ambiguity, Highway 1 also remained dormant. Mid-century America was still Jim Crow America, undeniably segregated, where Black musicians were disenfranchised. And so we come to the end of this period in the early 1960s, when an unexpected reunion between two old friends resulted in the work's premiere in Miami. In 1936, Still befriended conductor Fabian Savisky at a joint Hollywood Bowl concert. Their friendship continued. Then in 1961, their paths crossed again when Savisky performed Still's award-winning symphonic work, The Peaceful Land, at the University of Miami. This time, Still was successful in securing a performance. Now titled Highway 1 USA, the opera was presented on the final evening of University of Miami's fourth annual Festival of American Music. On Sunday, May 12th, in 1963, at Coral Gables High School Auditorium, there were 1,000 guests in attendance, and they gave a standing ovation. It is important to note at this point that the University of Miami is a predominantly white institution. It's unclear if the cast was predominantly Black or white, though I wager that the three main characters, Bob, Mary, and Nate, were performed by white singers, because the University of Miami had only begun racial integration in 1961. My observations from this period is that Still and Arve succeeded in producing Highway 1 as a racially ambiguous opera in 1963, though they had to wait two decades. In the next period, Highway 1 transforms into a Black opera. She had a dream of a son with learning, a child who would send nine forth over all the world. Whose words would command respect, whose deeds would win wild acclaim. Her life had no other meaning. In her mind, that prayer lingered constantly. Let's begin with the chronology of the work's performance history after its premiere. I will provide the year, then where it was produced. 1967, West Virginia State College. 1968, Citrus College. 1972, Opera South. 1974, 76, and 77 at Virginia Union University. 1975, Norfolk State College in Virginia. 1977, Opera Ebony. 1978, Morris Brown Opera Workshop at Morris Brown College in Atlanta, Georgia. 1979, New Theater Center of Washington, D.C., and 1980, Los Angeles Heritage Singers. Every college mentioned, except for Citrus College, and yes, that California Community College in Glendora, just 30 minutes east of downtown L.A., all but that one is and are HBCUs, Historically Black College or University. Additionally, three of the professional companies, Opera South, Opera Ebony, and the Los Angeles Heritage Singers, were in our Black institutions. Specifically, Opera South was an all-Black professional company sponsored by three HBCUs, Jackson State University, Utica Junior College, and Tougaloo College. From this list, it is clear that HBCUs shaped the performance history of Highway 1. And so in this next part of the episode, I want to consider what it means for HBCUs to produce Highway 1. To do this, I consider two questions. The first is, What does the narrative of Highway 1 mean as a Black story on HBCU campuses? And the second question, what does it mean for HBCUs to produce Highway 1 as a recovery of Black voices? Let's begin with the first question. What does it mean for Highway 1 to be a Black story performed on HBCU campuses? To answer this question, we must acknowledge the impact of HBCUs in American higher education. Research on HBCUs have all concluded that they provide consistent educational pathways for Black students. In early 2000s, surveys show that even though HBCUs represent only 3% of American colleges and universities, they enrolled almost 20% of Black college students and approximately 30% of all African-American bachelor degree recipients were educated at HBCUs. In other words, HBCUs exhibit much higher success rates in granting bachelor degrees than their counterparts at predominantly white institutions. We also know that HBCUs enroll more students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds than at predominantly white institutions. HBCUs attract students who are low income, first generation, single parents, or from underrepresented minority groups. The characters in Highway 1 echo the demographics of HBCUs. Bob, Mary, and Nate are working class, probably low income. Nate is a first-generation college student, and the emphasis on the dying wishes of Bob and Nate's mother hint at a possible single-parent household. The fracture of family dynamic speaks to the intersection of class and race in educational politics, and of the changing patterns of mobility within Black community. Nate is the liberal arts-educated college graduate who is expected to advance socially and therefore bring economic prosperity for the family, while Mary and Bob, who are not college-educated, maintain a low but seemingly stable living wage. This clash of two classes within the Black community recalls the classical versus industrial education debate between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington in the early 20th century. Let's listen to a short audio clip of Du Bois speaking of his disagreement with Washington regarding education. This autobiographical interview was recorded for Folkways Records in 1961.
And so I changed from studying the Negro problem to propaganda, to letting people know just what the Negro problem meant in what the colored people were suffering and what they were kept from doing. I was practically compelled to make this change because the people who were supporting Atlanta University were a little uneasy about the way in which I talked about the Negro problem. And pressure began to be put upon the university to do without my services. I had begun to criticize Booker Washington, saying it wasn't enough to teach Negroes trades. The Negroes had to have some voice in their government. They had to have protection in the courts, and they had to have trained men to lead them.
To summarize their differing perspectives, Du Bois believed that, quote, a classical liberal arts curriculum would confirm Black intellectual capacity and challenge white racial, economic, political, and social dominance. HBCUs should prepare broadly educated Black students to assume their rightful places as full co-equal citizens in America and the world, end quote. While Washington believed that industrial education would provide skills necessary to secure jobs and therefore economic stability and independence. And so to consider the first question, what does the narrative of Highway 1 mean as a Black story on HBCU campuses? To consider Highway 1 as a Black story is to consider the complex history of higher education for Black Americans. And question two, what does it mean for HBCUs to produce Highway 1 as a recovery of Black voices? The rich history of HBCUs producing Highway 1 truly demonstrates the significant positive impacts of HBCUs. Though the work's performance history began officially in a predominantly white institution in Miami, It was the students, faculty, and staff of HBCUs who championed the work for more than a decade and shepherded it into professional companies across the nation thereafter. Many scholars have noted HBCUs as catalysts and agents for change, citing well-known figures such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Toni Morrison, and Thurgood Marshall. Similarly, we should also acknowledge the millions of African Americans whose lives advance as a result of their education at HBCUs. To summarize, the second period offers a rich history of how historically Black colleges and universities transformed Highway 1 into a Black opera. And last, the third period, post-1980s. I consider this last period one of reparations. The first recording of the full opera was released in 2005, and in the last 4 years, there have been four productions by professional companies. Opera Theatre of St. Louis in 2021, Opera Ithaca in 2022, Little Opera Theatre of New York in 2023, and LA Opera in 2024. These four opera companies represent a range in size and history. Budget sizes vary between tens of thousands, such as the Little Opera of New York, to tens of millions, like St. Louis and LA. While the roots of LA Opera and Opera Theater of St. Louis date back to the 40s and 70s, respectively, the Little Opera of New York and Opera Ithaca began after 2000. All of these companies differ from those in the second period, in that none are strictly Black-owned. All of them, however, have presented a diversity of works, particularly in the recent years. For example, LA has championed BIPOC composers such as Rhiannon Giddens, Michael Abels, Gabriella Lena Frank, and Wang Ro. Women composers, including Emma O'Halloran and Du Yung, as well as forgotten chamber operas from the past, including Chevalier de St. George's, The Anonymous Lover, and of course, Zemlinsky's The Dwarf. I highlight these facts to show the versatility of Highway 1. The work is concise in many ways. Approximately 1 hour in length, set in one location, with three main soloists, three smaller role solo parts, and a chorus. Since 1963, the work's history demonstrates its viability in collegiate vocal programs, chamber opera companies, and large opera institutions. Depending on the venue, cast, and production, each performance of Highway 1 has and will continue to reflect America as an American story. Personally, I'm looking forward to LA Opera's production and asking myself during and after the performance, what can I learn from the opera? How has the American story evolved? And what does the story mean today? I hope you'll get a chance to ponder these questions as well. And so for now, I'm signing off. See you at the opera.
Don't miss this rarely performed one-act opera featured in our upcoming double bill. Tickets are on sale now at laopera.org. If you enjoyed listening to LA Opera's Behind the Curtain, subscribe and leave a rating or review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen. Don't forget to share this episode with your friends on your favorite social media, and we'll see you at the opera.